Hi, I'm Josh Kimmel. This is number 0508, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of The Stuff File Program, number 0508. And coming up on this edition of The Stuff File Program, NASA expert Rod Pyle is back on the show. He's the author of First on the Moon. We take a look back on this, the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing.
The further I get away from Apollo, and I write about it all the time, so I'm kind of an Apollo overload this year, but the further I get from it, the harder it is for me to believe that we pulled it off with that technology, because they were flying right at the edge of what machinery could do at that time. I mean, this stuff was developed in the early 60s for the most part, and then refined through the mid-60s until the 1969 landing, and they were working on the lunar module right up till a couple of months before they sent off Apollo 11 because it just wasn't ready.
Former NFLer and the co-host of American Ninja Warrior, Akbar Bajabiamila, is the author of Everyone Can Be a Ninja.
I get to bring a book to the market that really does talk about overcoming obstacles. It really is, to me, symbolic of what you see on the show. Everybody who's familiar with American Ninja Warrior, these athletes were overcoming obstacles, these crazy-looking obstacles. It's what inspired me to write the book. Really, my hosting the show for the last 8 years has really been a lecture hall for me. It has been a classroom where I've got to watch some ordinary athletes do some extraordinary things with their ability, and some of them with disabilities, and yet they don't make it their disability. They thrive beyond that. It's what I love.
Coleman Larkin, creator of Kentucky Turds, collectible manure from a Kentucky Derby winner.
I had an idea that if I could do a Kentucky horse turd preserved in this epoxy resin stuff, that would be right up their alley and something that people might be interested in. And then the timing just hit me. Why don't I take it to the next level, do a Kentucky Derby winning horse turd, and then maybe that would really get people excited.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0508 was Josh Kimmel, a talent agent who runs TBT Management. You can go to his website, which you'll find the link on our website at thestufffile.com, and see the host of clients that he represents. Thank you very much, Josh, for doing the guest slate on this edition of The Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? When a Florida deputy asked a woman if she had anything else on her during a routine traffic stop, he wasn't expecting what she did next. She proceeded to pull a one-foot-in-length alligator out of her yoga pants and placed it into the bed of the truck, the Charlotte County Sheriff's deputy said in an incident report. The driver, 22-year-old Michael Clemens, told deputies that he and his passenger, 25-year-old Ariel Macken LeQuire, were trying to collect frogs and snakes from under an overpass. The deputy then asked permission to search the bags in the truck to make sure they did not collect any wildlife they were not supposed to have. Ariel opened the backpack that was on the passenger's floorboard that revealed 41 small turtles. Then she pulled the alligator from her pants. Wow. You know, if you're hanging with a group of friends and you start off a story with, "I once dated a girl who pulled an alligator out of her pants," you know everyone in the group is going to start to lean in, right? I mean, this is a woman who is game for anything. Moving right along, sometimes a girl just wants a pretty new thing, but 18-year-old Ada Malcado and an unnamed minor accomplice let greed get the best of them. Lower Allen Township Police said Malcado and her helper browsed through the Victoria's Secret store in the Capital City Mall in Bethesda, Maryland, on April the 7th, carrying large shopping bags and talking on cell phones. While the miner acted as a lookout, Melcado allegedly shoveled delicates into her bag. How many delicates, you ask? Well, 375 hipster panties worth $3,937.50, 375 cut thongs worth the same amount as the last item, 1,000 thongs worth $10,500, and 250 raw cut hip-hugging panties worth $2,625, for a grand total of $21,000. Police later identified the thieves during a drug investigation in Fairfax County, Virginia. Wow. A drug investigation, you say? Well, we don't know Victoria's Secret, but we now certainly know Ada's. Okay, what began as a quiet family dinner at home quickly escalated into a front yard brawl on April 22nd in Bedford, Virginia. 56-year-old Mark Turner, his girlfriend, the girlfriend's son, and the son's girlfriend had retired to the front yard after dinner when an argument broke out between the two men about whether Chevrolet or Ford makes better trucks. According to the Bedford County Commonwealth's attorney, Wes Nance, Turner allegedly pulled out a knife but ended up slashing his girlfriend's back as she tried to calm the situation. Next, Turner went inside and retrieved a gun, but as the girlfriend again tried to get between him and her son, he allegedly shot the woman 5 times in the leg. He also shot the son in the arm, and 2 of his stray bullets hit the son's girlfriend in her back and cheek. Finally, according to prosecutors, Turner barricaded himself in the house, where police eventually shot him with a beanbag round and took him into custody. Turner was charged with felony malicious wounding, use of a firearm in the commission of a felony, and possession of a firearm by a felon. Okay, I still don't know which side of the argument Turner was on. Does he like Chevys or Fords? This is another story where I think the relationship involved is now over. You figure? Anybody wondering what Turner would do if you said you liked Toyotas? Wow. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an Idaho man broke his 100th Guinness World Record when he fit 100 lit candles in his mouth at one time. David Rush, whose previous records include the most corn kernels eaten using a toothpick in 3 minutes, crammed the candles into his mouth at the TEDx Boise event. A video of the attempt shows Rush, who uses his world record attempts to promote STEM education, placing the candles in his mouth before they are ignited by a member of his support team. Rush holds the candles in his mouth for a full 30 seconds. The previous record was 41 candles and was set back in 2018 in India. Okay. Again? Why? And isn't this just the ultimate case of waxy buildup? Yeah. Putting 100 candles in your mouth and lighting them seems like something Bugs Bunny would try to get Daffy Duck to do.
You're despicable.
Okay, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? This summer is the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 and man landing on the moon. NASA expert Rod Pyle is back on with us to talk about this topic. He's the editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, which is published by the National Space Society, and the author of more than a dozen books, including First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. Rod joins us once again from California via Skype. Hi, Rod.
Hey there, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us once again. You know, like so many of us who are old enough to remember when man landed on the moon way back when in 1969, it seemed to go so perfectly. But looking back in hindsight, what were some of the white-knuckle moments that either ground control had or the astronauts on the mission themselves?
Yeah, there were a few, and it's interesting. We talked about this before in your show, and the further I get away from Apollo, and I write about it all the time, so I'm kind of an Apollo overload this year, But the further I get from it, the harder it is for me to believe that we pulled it off with that technology, because they were flying right at the edge of what machinery could do at that time. I mean, this stuff was developed in the early 60s for the most part, and then refined through the mid-60s until the 1969 landing. And they were working on the lunar module, as you probably know, right up till a couple of months before they sent off Apollo 11, because it just wasn't ready. So while it had all been tried in one form or another, often whether you're talking about the Saturn V or the lunar module, there had only been a couple of successful tests before they actually took off. So just in sort of a global sense, we didn't have a lot of experience with the Saturn V, which is, you know, any big rocket like that is basically a bomb with one end open, letting all the energy slowly out the backside instead of one big kaboom. But if things go wrong, it can be one big kaboom. So the Saturn V itself, with 1 million gallons of fuel in it, all of which are explosive, was, you know, that was kind of concerning right there. You're sitting on top of this big thing. They did have an escape system, but it was still quite dangerous. So launch was one of those moments. And certainly getting into orbit was still something we didn't have a lot of experience with. And after they left Earth orbit and headed to the moon, that was the time when they had to detach the Apollo spacecraft itself, the command and service module, from the rocket, pull ahead of the rocket, turn around, push back slowly towards the rocket. And they're both traveling very fast at this point towards the moon, but relative speed is not a problem. And then they had to dock with the LEM and pull it free of the third stage. So the LEM itself was so fragile by this point. It had been lightened so much. There were a lot of parts of that, of the main pressure hull, that weren't much thicker than a Coke can. They were really thin and delicate. So there's a lot of concern about if you missed the docking port, you could punch right through the roof of that thing. So that was another one of those moments. But I think the ones that we think about the most are breaking into lunar orbit, getting out of lunar orbit, because if that single engine on the Apollo spacecraft had failed, in either case, you'd be stuck there. Although, if it had failed to break them into lunar orbit, at least through Apollo 11, you would have slung past the moon and come home. But after that, the way they flew the trajectories for the later missions after Apollo 12, if you missed your lunar insertion burn, you'd be stuck. And then finally, the lunar landing itself. And that's the one I think that was the biggest white knuckler for everybody, because it was just a complete question mark. It had never been done.
Once they got there and they successfully had their moonwalk, they then had to leave the moon. Was there ever a plan for any reason if they needed to be rescued from the lunar surface?
It was game over. They had considered various scenarios about how they might build a rescue craft or something, but the budget was tight and it just didn't make a lot of sense. And we were racing the end of this kind of artificially imposed end of the decade deadline that Kennedy had put in place. And really, that would have been 1970, the complete year of 1970, but everybody looked at it as 69, as did NASA. So when you landed on the moon, the lunar module came down on a descent stage and a descent engine. That was one engine system, and landed, and that fuel was depleted, and that stage would be left behind. So when they left, they had to separate from that landing stage, and just the top half came back with a separate engine, separate fuel supply. So there's a couple things that had to happen. First, everything had to arm properly electrically. Then when you hit the launch button on the lunar module, four explosive bolts had to shear with little explosive charges that held one stage to the other. And more worryingly, there was a 4-inch wire bundle. They didn't want any connectors coming loose during flight or landing. So they had solid wires, a 4-inch bundle of them running from the top stage to the bottom stage. That had to be cut with an explosive-powered guillotine, a couple of blades. And this all happened within microseconds, of course, and then the thing would take off. Now, that's assuming that the ascent engine fired at all. It was a very simple system, used fuels called hypergolics that exploded on contact, so you didn't even igniter. But the valves had to open, and at one point before the mission, Armstrong had asked the designers of the lunar module, how do those valves work? And they said, well, they have little explosive charges on them. Don't worry, they're perfect. He said, can you just put a manual override on there, you know, like the kind of valve you have on a hose at your house? And they said, nah, it's too complex and too much weight. Don't worry, they'll work. So they did, fortunately, every time. But there was always that chance you'd push that button and nothing would happen, and there you'd be stuck. Now, there is one more interesting thing here. When Aldrin and Armstrong were leaving the lunar module to go down and take their moonwalk, they didn't hear it in the vacuum because, of course, the hatch was open, so it was in a vacuum. but there was a little switch tab that snapped off, and they didn't see it till they got back in the LEM a couple hours before they were going to leave. That was the arming switch for the ascent engine. And when they discovered that upon returning, they radioed down to Houston and said, we broke the go switch. And they went, oh, dear. So the next few hours, all the astronauts are trying to sleep, trying not to think about this. NASA was trying to work out, okay, what are the workarounds so we can bypass that circuit? But at the end, Buzz Aldrin looked at it with that engineer's mind of his, pulled a felt-tip pen out of his pocket, jammed it in the socket, flipped the breaker, and they were good to go. So,
wow,
crisis averted for 39 cents.
That's amazing. Now, we talk about the astronauts. There's Neil Armstrong. You just mentioned Buzz Aldrin. And, of course, the man I like to refer to as the world's first Uber driver, Michael Collins. While he was floating around in the command module, well, actually, let me rephrase that. While those two guys were down on the surface, he was floating around on the command module doing what exactly?
He was taking observations through a telescope, a low-powered telescope from orbit, trying to find exactly where the lunar module had touched down. Because when they were coming in, there were a couple of problems that screwed up their navigation, and nobody was quite sure where they were. And they wanted to make sure for future landings that they could be much more accurate. So if I can just back up a second, when the lunar module separated from the command module, there was a little bit of, this is before they landed, there's a little bit of air left in that docking tunnel, and it was just enough of a pop that it shoved them a number of miles downrange from where they were supposed to be. So as Armstrong's bringing the LEM down, he's looking out the window, and he realizes they've overflown their targeted craters from the maps he was familiar with. So he knew he was going to have to find a new landing area past where he expected to be. And of course, this is all part of the contingency planning, but when you're down there scooting over the surface at a couple hundred feet, it looks very different than it does from orbital maps because nobody had landed there yet. So they're a little off their bearings. So Collins was spending a lot of time trying to find him, and then a lot of time also taking photographs and doing some experiments that they had scheduled for him. So he was busy the whole time.
Fascinating. Now, you, for your book, which is First on the Moon, you had the opportunity to talk to the families of some of these astronauts. Again, we all have an idea of how we remember the mission. Was it different for them? I would assume it was.
It was, although, you know, I think, I interviewed one of Aldrin's sons and one of Armstrong's sons, and Armstrong's son said, you know, it was a life pretty much like anybody else's. We didn't realize how special this was, because they were born fairly quickly after they're born, they all moved to Houston, I think 63, 64 area. So they grew up in a suburb where there were astronauts down the street. The mission chiefs were down the street. The flight directors were down the street. So it was a NASA family. So that's just what you knew. And as Armstrong's son put it, Dad was just exactly as he described himself, a white shirt, skinny tie, nerdy pocket protector engineer. And he was quite happy with that. And was very much kind of a Norman Rockwell character, you know, be good, do right, respect your neighbors kind of guy. Aldrin's son, Andy Aldrin, who I serve on a board with, so we've gotten to know each other fairly well. That interview was fascinating because he said, you know, the same thing. It was just regular neighborhood growing up for us. He said, I was much more interested in football than I was about anything going on the moon or science until later. But what I did really enjoy from that interview, he said, that he had kind of a different take on. He said, I'm going to tell you something I haven't told any writer before, which, of course, that's heaven to me, right? So I said, okay, I'm ready. And he said, well, my dad was on the moon. I wasn't worried about him falling over and hurting himself because I knew that NASA was really good at what they did and they'd train for this. And I wasn't worried about him getting stranded on the moon because I knew that NASA was really smart and they'd figure it out. He said, what I worried about most was I was looking at that cable between the lunar module and the TV camera thinking, if my dad trips over that, it's going to be so embarrassing when I get back to school in September to explain that to my friends. I thought that sounds like a real teenager's mindset, you know?
Well, the thing, and you've had a chance to talk to a lot of people at NASA. I've been lucky enough to talk to a couple of astronauts who actually been on the moon. And the thing that I found so interesting about them, and I think you might agree, is for guys who went to the moon, they were incredibly down to earth.
They are. And of course, when you're interviewing these guys, you don't want to ask the obvious, what's it like to be on the moon? Because how can anybody describe what it's like to be on the moon? So you try to find different ways to phrase these questions. What were the colors like? What was their sensation? But I was talking to Al Bean, who was on Apollo 12, who's one of the few that came back and left NASA to do something really different. He decided to devote his life to painting because art was his true second calling. So he's really got the mind of an artist. You know, he's a very right-brained guy as well as being an engineer and an astronaut. And I said, you know, at some point when you're walking up to a crater that no human being has not only ever set foot in, but not even been able to see from Earth, that must be a remarkable moment of incredible discovery and an exploration mindset and all that. And he just looked at me and smiled and said, it was just like the simulations. Wow. I thought, well, that pretty much explains it.
I've had that conversation with Alan Bean too, and he was an amazing man. As are you, sir, and your books. The latest one, or this one anyway, is First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. By the way, I know there's another book we should really mention, and that is Space 2.0, which is another one that you came up with this year. I thank you once again, Rod, for being on the program with us.
Thank you.
NASA expert Rod Pyle, author of First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. He also has other new titles you might want to check out, including Space 2.0, How Private Spaceflight, a Resurgent NASA, and International Partners Are Creating a New Space Age. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the page for this show, which is show number 0508, and you'll find links to Rod's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at Patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's now gluten-free.
And still to come, we'll talk to the author of Everyone Can Be a Ninja, plus we'll meet the creator of Kentucky Turds. Yes, you too can own some manure from a Kentucky Derby winner. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and much more in Stuff File News here on the Stuff File Program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Play and also iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. Now, regular listeners to the Stuff File program may remember a story we brought to you exactly 1 year ago in May of 2018. It was the story of Thomas Tramaglini, the superintendent of Kenilworth Public Schools in New Jersey, who pleaded guilty to defecating on the Homedale High School track and football field on a daily basis. Well, this year, on April 30th, Tramaglini filed a lawsuit against the Homedale Police Department for releasing his mugshot, claiming doing so tarnished his reputation and altered his life forever. Tramaglini's actions earned him the nickname Pooperintendent, and he claims to be underemployed and fighting for any semblance of normalcy that he can create for himself and his family. However, he also negotiated a separation agreement of more than $100,000 with the district in August of 2018. So, he got $100,000 as a separation agreement last summer. I wonder if he used any of it to add or update bathrooms in his house. Yeah. Meanwhile, a South Dakota man is accused of stealing $500 worth of sex toys from a couple's home over a period of about 2 years. 25-year-old Brody Fuchs, that's F-U-C-H-S, folks, of Tyndall, is charged with second-degree burglary. Bonhomme County Sheriff's Deputy Brian McGuire says Fuchs took a bunch of the items from a residence in Tyndall, which is near the Nebraska border. An affidavit said the couple had installed a camera system inside the house, which caught Fuchs entering the home for about 40 seconds then leaving. Seems like he knew exactly where to go. A deputy recovered a number of sex toys during a search of the suspect's residence. McGuire did not say whether Fuchs knew the couple. Well, if he doesn't know the couple, what I'd like to know is, how does he know that breaking into the house multiple times in a 2-year period would garner sex toys? Also, what was he doing with them? And does the couple want them back? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Colorado's massive snow load this year led to a huge number of avalanches with multiple casualties. Now that the spring melt has started, that danger has passed, but a related danger is thawing out with the snow, and the State Department of Transportation is warning of the risks. You see, in order to control the avalanche danger during the winter, authorities decided it was best to trigger avalanches while the mountains were cleared of people. They did this by shooting about 1,500 howitzer rounds at a snowpack to safely trigger avalanches. They heard the explosions of about 1,478 of them. The remaining 22? Nothing.
Where's the kaboom? There was supposed to be an earth-shattering kaboom.
So now the DOT is warning hikers that they need to beware of brightly colored metal objects that look like torpedoes. In other words, unexploded mortar shells. It's an explosive, so you definitely don't want to do anything to move it, said a DOT official. On the other hand, the outdoors creed is leave the trail cleaner than you found it, so I don't know. Anyway, I gotta think that there's something up there living naturally that will set off the remaining 22, everything from a hare to bear and all creatures in between. Bet they'll get a bang out of it.
Where's the kaboom? There was supposed to be an earth-shattering kaboom.
And let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Akbar Bajabiamila is a former NFL player, co-host of NFL Fantasy Live on the NFL Network, and host of NBC's American Ninja Warrior, which is also seen here in Canada on CTV. Akbar also has a new book out called Everyone Can Be a Ninja, Find Your Inner Warrior and Achieve Your Dreams. He joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Akbar.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. Yeah, today's been a busy day. It's crazy. Yesterday, celebrated my 40th birthday. Today, the book release of Everyone Can Be a Ninja. So, milestone in that I reached 40 and that I wrote my first book. So, it's been a busy year, but no doubt about it, it's been so fulfilling just because I get to bring a book to the market that really does talk about and about overcoming obstacles. And it really is, to me, symbolic of what you see on the show. Everybody who's familiar with American Ninja Warrior, you see these athletes were overcoming obstacles, these crazy looking obstacles. And it's what inspired me to write the book. Really, my hosting the show for the last 8 years has really been a lecture hall for me. It has been a classroom where I've got to watch some extraordinary athletes do some extraordinary ordinary athletes do some extraordinary things with their ability, and some of them with disabilities, and yet they don't make it their disability. They thrive beyond that, and it's what I love. And so I wanted to tell a different story. I know the book says everyone can be a ninja, but I'm talking about a ninja in life and overcoming those personal obstacles. So I really go in this book, and I tell my story on the obstacles that I had to overcome growing up in South Central Los Angeles. I have friends like Allison Felix, who's the most decorated Olympic female athlete in the world. And she tells how she had to overcome these obstacles to become an Olympic gold medalist. And so often we see people that are successful, like an Allison Felix, and people just think, she came out the womb already destined for success and greatness. But, you know, that wasn't always the case, and people will be surprised to understand just the maturation rate for an Allison Felix, or like my former teammate, Nnamdi Asamoah, who played in the NFL. He's a first-round draft pick. We came in as rookies, and all of a sudden, he was labeled a first-round draft pick and then turned it around to become one of the elite cornerbacks in the NFL, shut-down corner in the National Football League.
Now, you believe that you shouldn't take no for an answer, or you shouldn't wait for someone to give you an opportunity. You just mentioned a friend of yours who came into the league at the same time you did, who was a first-round draft pick. You were undrafted. How did that affect you, if at all?
Well, it had a major impact on me because, you know, everyone coming into the NFL had some success in college. And I thought that at one point, you know, I have a brother in the NFL. I thought, you know, look, I'd get a shot. I didn't think I had any wild imaginations that I'd be drafted in the first round. But I thought for sure at some point late in the draft, I'd be drafted. And when that didn't happen, it was a rude awakening. Like, hey, like nothing is guaranteed. You can put in a lot of work towards something and not achieve a goal that you perhaps set out. And for those hours and hours that I waited for the phone to ring to be invited as an undrafted free agent. You don't get drafted. You have to be invited now. And so now all of a sudden I'm sitting in this situation like, oh man, I'm going in and I tell this story. And this is just part of my story. Yes, it happened in the NFL, but it's a bigger story than athletics. It's a story about overcoming, you know, the odds where I remember going in, they gave me the number 69. As you can imagine, there are a lot of colorful jokes about that. As a defensive lineman, you don't want to wear a 60 number. That means you're sorry. Like, that's an offensive lineman number. You don't want to wear that number. And I had to work through not only the crazy numbering, but I also had to work down the depth chart. I mean, they drafted a first-round defensive end. They drafted the linebacker that they converted to defensive end in the third round. They drafted a fourth-round speed defensive end. And here I come as an undrafted free agent. Oh, by the way, they had two veteran defensive ends that already had a long NFL career. So, I mean, everything was stacked up against me. And there were so many lessons in the moment that I didn't recognize, but I can look back now and I can see sort of the foundation in which allowed me to succeed, even though the odds were stacked against me.
Now, one of the things that you and I actually do have in common here in North America is that we are children of immigrants. And I think, generally speaking, immigrants or children of immigrants, rather, have a drive that is instilled in them by their parents. What I want to know is, with your book, how do you instill that drive in someone who has a longer lineage in North America? Because I find that there seems to be a divide there. You know, immigrants and first-born children, first-generation children, seem to just have a natural drive that some people sometimes lack.
Can I just first off say that that's the best question I think I've heard all day throughout this radio tour, because I think you hit me right in the heart, and it's something that I've always thought inside and have internalized inside, but I've never actually said it out loud or actually even processed it in the way you just said it. But you're right. And I think growing up, when you see the grind, because my father, who I tell his story and how he came to this country after the Biafra War in Nigeria and came to this country for a better life, you know, when you come in for like I'm sure there's a lot of insecurity coming into a foreign land, not really speaking the language, being extremely different in a time in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s. It was just different times. You're coming into a whole new culture. And so what my dad instilled in us in that burning your candle is one of the major themes in the story. But to answer your question directly, I think the way people can relate that have a longer lineage in North America is that I am in the middle. I've seen my father, who came to this country from Nigeria, but I also grew up in the hood in South Central Los Angeles. So I understand the obstacles that one would have growing up in North America, in this culture. And yet I can also understand a little bit of the culture because I have a direct connection with it through my father. And so I think the biggest difference is the ability to assess opportunities and be relentless in your pursuit for opportunities. Because sometimes if opportunities are always given to you, you take it for granted. And when you take those things for granted, that's when I think apathy sets in. It'll be there. It'll be there. Like I even have to look at myself too, even the way I raise my kids. My kids, they grew up way different than I grew up. And I also want to make sure that they don't lose that edge, because what my family and my parents, like my mom and dad, they gave me an edge. And the edge was hustle. The edge was the ability to identify opportunities. I talk about identifying an opportunity to start broadcasting. My brother had a successful NFL career, played for the Green Bay Packers. He's all-time sack leader, Hall of Famer for the Green Bay Packers. I don't have that to my name. And so, as you know, for former athletes getting into broadcasting and TV, you really do have to have some sort of transferable name that can relate to, so people can relate to, either you're a Super Bowl winner, a Hall of Famer, you had some miraculous catch or something, some sort of fame. I didn't have that. I didn't have that at all. And I was able, because of the hustle and the grind, and the ability to assess and locate opportunities, I went back to the place where I had the most equity, which was most face time, most recognition, to San Diego. I played at San Diego State, played football there for 4 years. Then I went to play for the Chargers for a little bit before, after the Raiders. And I went to a local NBC station and I said, look, no one's given me an opportunity to get on TV because I don't have a big name. I said, I would do the post-game show for the Chargers and for the San Diego State Aztecs for free if you'll let me, if you'll give me my tape. They go, what? Absolutely. Because so many former players come in there and they retire, they go to San Diego, but they want to be paid to be on TV. You don't pay me. But there again, that's the that whole opportunity. When so many opportunities just been given to you, you can. It's easy to develop this entitlement that, hey, things are supposed to just fall for me. Things are supposed to happen. You're supposed to pay me. Well, I was willing to do what others weren't, and I went through the back door and I said I would work free. And of course, did I have pride? Absolutely. Oh, here I am. You know, just transition from the NFL. People look at me in a certain way, like, oh, you got money. What you working for? Why do you have to be at work? And, you know, why would you work for free? If I was you, I would never work for free. They better pay me. And I was like, no, like, I need to learn a new skill. I'm an apprentice again. I'm starting new. There's a whole new skill set. My football skills, physical skills, doesn't translate to the camera. Like, I have to be able to learn this new skill set. And so I bet on the fact that I would learn the skill at a high enough level that I would be able to advance and keep moving forward.
You are definitely an inspiration and a role model as far as what you're doing and just what you said. And also with your book, Everyone Can Be a Ninja. And I also, we just have about a minute. I know that there's something else that you also do very well. You're also a huge advocate of financial literacy, right?
Yes, I am. And it really started when I made it to the NFL. And I realized that there's so much pressure not to go broke as an athlete. But then I started to think, there's no way in our formal education where we ever learn about literacy. And so I wanted to go back, and I did that starting my rookie year, going back to elementary schools and teaching kids in the inner city about financial literacy, just the basics, not over-talking them, meeting them where they are, scaling it to size, the information to size, so they could understand what it meant for them, so they could learn and feel more confident when they had their opportunity to come into money. It's one of the biggest travesties in all of North America when it comes to financial literacy. It's like we don't talk about it at an early enough stage. We don't even talk about it in college.
One quick question. Your book, Everyone Can Be a Ninja. Was there a particular age group that you wrote this book for? Was it for the young, or can it be a book that has meaning and truth for anyone at any age?
Yeah, at any age. And I really designed it for the demographics of the show, which is 15 to 68. And so it can take you from if you're 15 all the way into your older, because I think the one thing that we all can say that we have in common is we have obstacles that we have to overcome in our life. So it's an inspiring book that really will inspire you through the different stories from my story, Allison Felix, former teammate, NFL player, Nnamdi Asmal, and some of the ninjas on the show. They tell their stories on the obstacles they've had to overcome. I've been inspired to write it because I wanted to tell a book and give a book to the world about overcoming obstacles.
Akbar, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Akbar Bajabiamila, author of Everyone Can Be a Ninja, Find Your Inner Warrior and Achieve Your Dreams. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0508, and you'll find links to Akbar's website and also links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
Got something for the mailbag? Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Stick around. There's more Stuff File coming your way in a moment.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that puts a smile on your face and a skip in your step. Please avoid skipping if you are driving.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about Kentucky turds. Plus, we do have an idiot of the day and more Stuff File news here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, video released by Florida Highway Patrol shows a man driving westbound on I-4 while sitting on top of his sunroof. Police arrested 70-year-old Leonard Olson after an off-duty Hillsborough County Sheriff's deputy recorded video of the man's actions and notified FHP. While following the driver, the off-duty deputy says the vehicle driven by Olson was going more than 100 miles per hour, then suddenly slowed down to 40. At one point, the off-duty officer observed the driver stand up and sit on his open sunroof while the vehicle was still traveling. Troopers pulled over Olson on U.S. 98 in Lakeland and asked him about reports of him sitting on top of his sunroof. Olson initially said he didn't know about that. Olson then told deputies that he wanted to turn himself in. When asked why, the arrest report claims Olson stated, "My wife treats me like a servant and she's the mistress and I'm tired of this bleep." Olson then stated he would rather go to jail than go back home. He was taken into custody. When troopers showed Olson video of him sitting on the top of his sunroof while driving, Olson then admitted that it was him, and he stated that his vehicle was on cruise control at the time. "The car drives itself and has a gigantic computer in it," Olson added. "I thought it would be a nice way to praise God for a minute, and I thought it would be nice at the time, and that's what I did." Olson is now charged with reckless driving, which is a misdemeanor. Okay, aren't you more curious about the relationship Olson has with his wife? I mean, there's nothing in this story that says the guy was impaired. So, he's actually stone-cold sober when he says he'd rather go to jail than go home to his wife. Wow. Life's rough when prison is more preferable to matrimony. Anyway, let's get to our third guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? I'm sure there are many of you out there who have quietly wondered to themselves, how do I get championship manure from a Kentucky Derby winner? Well, wonder no more, because now you can. It's called Kentucky Turds. It's the product of 1997 winner Silver Charm, and it sells for $200 a pop. Joining us right now from Kentucky is Coleman Larkin, who is selling what's left behind by Silver Charm. Hi, Coleman.
Hey, what's up?
Thanks for being on the program with us. How did you even come up with this idea?
Drugs. I'm on a lot of drugs. No, don't do drugs. So I'm an artist. Mixed media collage is what I'd call it. You know, I'm taking magazine clippings, found objects, and that kind of thing. And then, so I'll arrange it, and I'll coat it in a material called epoxy resin, which is like a two-part. Starts as a liquid, you mix it together, it cures by a chemical reaction, turns into like a really hard, clear plastic. So I've been doing that for about 10 years. and I had some left over. Thought it would be funny if I tried to make like a little paperweight or something out of my cat's turds. I got a one-eyed cat. Shout out to Sunny Boy. That did not go well. When you mix the two together, it gets really hot for one thing. So basically what I ended up with was a boiled cat turd and a brown cracked piece of burnt plastic. Not cool. But I've been working with these guys at a company called Kentucky for Kentucky, based in Lexington, Kentucky. They're into weird stuff. I write weird articles for them. They sell weird, funny products. They did some gold-plated Kentucky Fried Chicken bone necklaces one time. And they also did some Kentucky Fried Chicken scented candles, which were really popular. So I had an idea that if I could do a Kentucky horse turd preserved in this epoxy resin stuff, that would be right up their alley and something that people might be interested in. And then the timing just hit me. Why don't I take it to the next level, do a Kentucky Derby winning horse turd, and then maybe that would really get people excited. And it did.
Okay, so a lot of horses have won the Kentucky Derby. A lot are still around. You went back to 1997 and Silver Charm. Was that the first horse you approached, or the first horse's owner that you approached? What was that process like? How did you get Silver Charm?
No, Silver Charm actually wasn't the first. I thought that I could take it to the next level and get some Triple Crown winning Kentucky Derby horse turds. So I originally went after American Pharoah and Justified, which are both pretty recent Triple Crown winners, and they're both at the same farm in Kentucky, Coolmore Farms. So I reached out to them, and they were not enthusiastic about it. You know, they're kind of stuffy blue blood types, so I could tell they weren't thrilled with the idea. So I just said thanks and went back to the drawing board. But then it occurred to me that, like I mentioned before, I'm a writer. I write for magazines and stuff. And a long time ago, I wrote an article about this guy, Michael Blower, who runs Old Friends Farm in Georgetown. It's a nonprofit thoroughbred retirement farm. He's a super cool guy. Used to be the film critic for the Boston Globe. Loves weird ideas. He took an enormous risk doing what he does at Old Friends. So I thought if anybody would be into it, I could call him up, and he at least wouldn't hang up on me. So shot him an email, and he loved it. He said it was a great idea, so I could come out anytime. He took me out there, hung out with Silver Charm. He didn't mind. Went out in the paddock, scooped up about 100 or so toads, made it happen.
Wow. Now, we should mention you didn't get Justify. You didn't get American Pharoah, both Triple Crown winners, but this particular horse, Silver Charm, is no slouch. He won the Kentucky Derby, he won the Preakness, and was a close second to the Belmont. So as close to the Triple Crown as you can possibly get without winning it. So that's not bad. That's not bad at all. So how did you decide to come up with the price of $200 a pop, or should I say $200 a poop?
Well, It's a time-consuming process. It really is, and it takes a lot of work. And I went through a lot of trial and error to get to it, to make it work. And I think it's a piece of art, you know. And it's like we said, it's Silver Charm. That's no slouch. That's a almost Triple Crown winner, and probably won't be around much longer. So I think it's a special piece of sports memorabilia that going to last an eternity. You know, people spend that much money on lots of stupid sports stuff that, or, you know, for example, like here in Kentucky, they'll spend that much money on a bottle of bourbon or whatever, and that's gone in a month or so. Or you spend that much money at the racetrack betting on the Kentucky Derby, that's gone in a day. This is a piece of Kentucky Derby history that you can keep forever. So I think $200 is a fair price, and we've been selling.
So while Silver Charm is still alive, needless to say, there's an endless supply of this stuff. So how much of this are you marketing?
It's a limited supply, so that's important too. It's, like I said, it's tough to make. So it took me a long time to make the amount we have, which is about, or depending on how many we've sold by now, there's probably about 80 of them left or something like that. So it's a limited supply. I don't plan on doing any more Silver Shine, at least not this year. Maybe if we sell out, something we'll do next year, but supplies are limited, so I'm not going to flood the market with these horse turds and drive the price down. Your investment is safe.
Okay. Now, you say you have about 80 left. How many did you do in total?
It was like 115, I think, ended up being.
Now that you have a certain amount of notoriety for having done this, there's a certain amount of press that's being done. Have you thought in the future of going back to the owners of Justify and American Pharoah and see if they change their mind?
Yeah, I'd hope so. I'd like to, like I said, maybe if we do it next year around the Derby, maybe I could expand the line to other Derby winners or hopefully a Triple Crown winner maybe. And maybe, you know, with the Old Friends angle, like I said, we're giving a portion of the sales to Old Friends, which is a nonprofit. They could definitely use the money. So maybe other farms, other Derby winning owners would get on board, and we could sell a few more of these and raise some more money for Old Friends.
Now, for those who have no idea what this looks like, it's available in a 16-ounce jar with a tag of authentication, and It's harvested, as you mentioned, from the horse and preserved in an epoxy resin. Can you open the jar, and also, does it smell?
It does not smell. It's very hygienic. I suffered through all that, so you don't have to. So I don't know if you've ever seen here in the American South, we were big on canning, especially in Kentucky, preserving the harvest, green beans and corn and that kind of thing. So 16-ounce mason jar, it looks really sharp. It's got a nice white lid on it. Like you said, it comes with a hand stamp signed by me, certificate of authenticity, guaranteed immortal or your money back, and we also put a cool quality preservation strip over the top. So, I mean, if you want to take the top off, you can, but you're just going to be looking at, you know, hard piece of plastic on the inside. But we keep this tamper-proof seal on it, so you know it's legit.
And now that you've done this, I mean, I'm calling you here from Montreal. What kind of notoriety have you received? What kind of media attention?
About all of it, it seems like. You know, we thought for sure it would be something that got people's attention, but it definitely surpassed our expectations. You know, it started with very local interest, and that grew to regional and then statewide, and then Associated Press picked it up, and before you know it, it was in loads of newspapers nationally, New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, everywhere. I'm getting calls from radio stations, you guys, it's crazy.
Well, you certainly put yourself out there and given new life to the amazing career, the already amazing career of Silver Charm. You know, a lot of times horses are put out to stud. This is a whole new ball game you've created here.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, if you're not familiar with Old Friends Farm in Georgetown, Kentucky, they should definitely look it up. The guy's doing amazing work. You know, people probably have this idea that Derby-winning horses go on to have these amazing, idyllic lives, but it's not always the case. You know, they go to stud, and once they're done with them for that, a lot of them don't make it. They get shipped overseas. They're killed because they're expensive to keep. But this guy, Michael, Old Friends, you know, he just loves the sport and loves these horses and gives them an amazing life.
Interesting concept indeed. Coleman, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Yeah, Peter, thanks for having me. It was awesome.
Coleman Larkin, who has created Kentucky Turds. If you still want to purchase one, you can at ky4ky.com. By the way, the website for the Old Friends Farm is oldfriendsequine.org, and you can check out Coleman's website at colemanlarkin.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0508, and you'll find all of those links. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot! of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff file presents the idiot of the day.
Hashtag don't do that. That was the advice Audrain County Sheriff Matt Aller gave in a wild Facebook post detailing all the illegal things he said one woman did while bailing her boyfriend out of jail. I can't make this stuff up, the post began. Aller said it was a normal day in the office when he noticed a woman getting arrested in the building on one of the security monitors. The woman, Amanda Smith, reportedly drove to the jail on a revoked license. She drove right to the building thinking the cops wouldn't notice. The deputy recognized her and knew she was revoked. But the day did not end with just one felony for Smith. Aller said he saw Smith digging around her bra and pants and asked the chief deputy to review the footage. The chief deputy approached Smith and asked her for the bag of meth that she had on her person in the jail. When she looked confused, the deputy chief pointed at the wall-mounted security camera. She looked at the camera, then cried and dug the meth out of her pants and gave it up. Another felony. Don't do that, Aller said. Aller said the takeaway is simple. If you want to commit a couple of felonies, don't do it at a sheriff's office. Which now, of course, leads me to my usual question. Why? Oh, why? Would you drive to a police station on a suspended license to bail out your boyfriend while you're carrying meth? One reason and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0508. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0508. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Today's broadcast could be heard directly in your home, car, or wireless device, or on your computer, so you can listen on an outpatient basis. For those of you hearing this show directly inside your head, please adjust your medication.